It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, our guest says great meals don't have to be expensive. We'll get advice on cooking on a budget.
First, President Trump announced his decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord yesterday, a landmark agreement between 195 countries to fight climate change. Trump said the U.S. would try to negotiate a better deal because he believes the current one imposed unfair standards on the U.S. that hurts workers and the economy.
Right now, the U.S. is the planet's second largest carbon dioxide producer, and the decision has put the president at odds with members of the international and scientific communities. In his speech yesterday, he said that even if the U.S. did go along with the promises it made to prevent climate change in the Paris climate deal, it wouldn't make much of a difference.
Even if the Paris Agreement were implemented in full, with total compliance from all nations, it is estimated it would only produce a 0.2 of 1 degree, think of that, this much Celsius reduction in global temperature by the year 2100. Tiny, tiny amount.
Jonathan Martin is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and he joins us now to tell us what the potential environmental impact of the president's decision could be. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Very nice to be here.
Well, as we heard yesterday, President Trump announced the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. How big are the environmental consequences as you see it?
Well, I think they're potentially quite large. I think that clip that we just heard, the president saying about a 0.2 degree temperature decrease, that's in contrast to if business as usual continues until the year 2100, we have a range between 5 and 8 degrees Celsius temperature increase of the global average temperature, which is absolutely unsustainable in the sense that, the planet is not in danger of disappearing, but our way of life and our ability to feed our population and to water it adequately and all these other things that we've become accustomed to, that's in real peril if we end up with a 5 to 8 degree temperature increase over the next century. So this is a misleading statement by him. We're already at about a 2 degree C increase in the last 1.5 degree C increase in the last 150 or so years on the global average. So to bend it back to be actually something below zero would be a staggering accomplishment. And he talks about it as if it's a pittance.
Now, the U.S. initially committed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 26% to 28% by the year 2025. Can you put those numbers into context for us? So what would that have meant?
It would have meant a substantial change in the way that we do our main business of commuting and powering our economy. But it would have been gradually. It wouldn't have happened overnight. No one was advocating that we suddenly abandon petroleum products and use nothing but the so-called sustainable energies starting next week. But over a long period of time, if you can reduce your reliance on petroleum-based products, you change how much of an increase in the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere that human activity has produced. It's been a substantial increase. We've never been at 400 parts carbon dioxide per million molecules in the geologic history of the Earth in the last couple of million years minimum, and we don't know for sure about further back than that. So we're in uncharted territory right now, and it's largely, almost entirely a function of human activity in the last 150 years. So to continue or to not curtail our use is going to exacerbate that problem. To actually rise to that challenge and meet those goals would actually begin to pull us back to a more sustainable environment.
Now, the Paris deal has a goal of keeping the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. As you said, we're in uncharted waters here, but can you try to paint a picture of the kind of climate scenario that 2 degree ceiling was looking to avoid?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's still a question of open debate. We're trying to figure out what does it. Here's the issue: a global average change in the temperature of 2 degrees is not exactly going to manifest itself as a 2 degree change in your average temperature in your backyard every year that goes by. So there are going to be certain places on the globe that will not warm at all. There'll be other places that will warm more dramatically. It would alter the circulation of the whole hemisphere, both northern and southern hemispheres, and that will, of course, impact the local distribution of weather systems and rain and various other types of precipitation that will come. So it isn't easy to know how a global average will manifest itself in the day-to-day travails of the weather. And that's one of the issues that's a really big question mark still, although we're getting further and further along in trying to answer that. And you sometimes hear people talk about more extreme weather events and, you know, more intense hurricanes as one particular type of weather event. And the connections between a global average change in the temperature and some of those scenarios is becoming a little bit clearer. But I would say, certainly as a weather scientist primarily, I would say that we're still not at a point where I feel really confident about those predictions. And that's a great uncertainty.
John Martin's with us right now, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the environmental impact of the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. And, John, there has been, between the president and the scientific community, not speaking for everyone here, but there has been some tension. Some scientists saying that there has been a de-emphasis of science, that there's concerns about the way science may or may not be applied in the new administration. What does this decision by the president add to that tension?
Well, you're right. There is that tension, that sort of anticipation that things will continuously get worse from the perspective of our scientists and the energy that they devote to try and understand nature and then bring it to bear on the shaping of public policy. Will their enthusiasm wane in the face of an administration that seems reluctant at a minimum to take its advice? Quite contrary to the first Republican president that we ever had, Abraham Lincoln, establishing the National Academy of Sciences for the very reason to have science inform public policy. So we've gone a long way in 150 years. But that, it does increase the tension in the sense that we don't feel, I guess we get to feel more and more marginalized as what we're trying to help do for society, learning things about nature. And so that's one of the things that I woke up with thinking about today. When I was a five-year-old boy, my dad let me stay up way beyond a five-year-old's bedtime to watch Neil Armstrong make the first footprints on the moon. We rose to challenges then, and now we're shrinking from one. And that doesn't feel American to me.
Is that something you've seen? You talked about your own personal reaction. Have you seen that reaction with others in the scientific community, both in the state, in this country, and also globally?
I'd have to say in the state is the place where I've had much of my focus, particularly in my own department. We have one of my very esteemed colleagues who we don't want to lose people in our department. We don't want to lose people at our great university. But she has decided that in order to weather the storm that she thinks is coming in the next several years, she accepted an offer to go to another university. And part of the deal that she accepted was a fairly substantial research package, untethered to federal monies. And so this will give her a safe harbor for the next four, perhaps longer, a number of years. And so I don't think she's alone. I think that's probably a widespread concern.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Charlie joining us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I believe in that there is man-made influence on the climate and that there is climate change, and I don't deny that per se. But this Paris Agreement seemed to focus on the United States to make them the scapegoat for other countries. India and China, for instance, were not asked to have any real cuts in their production of carbon emissions and stuff like that. So why should the U.S. be part of an agreement that hurts itself?
Charlie, thank you for that call. And we have a clip of the president talking about that very topic. Here he is.
China will be allowed to build hundreds of additional coal plants. So we can't build the plants, but they can, according to this agreement. India will be allowed to double its coal production by 2020. Think of it. India can double their coal production. We're supposed to get rid of ours.
And I want to add here that PolitiFact noted in the agreement that countries, they have to declare how much they'll lower their greenhouse gas emissions, but it doesn't dictate what they have to do to get there explicitly. So technically, you know, they could build coal plants, I suppose. So, John, do you think that the president has a point there in saying that other countries are not doing the heavy lifting that the United States is or have opportunities that the United States is denied?
I think your comment just before, Veronica, was a really good one, that the agreement doesn't demand what what is the nature of your reduction. It just demands a reduction or challenges countries to a reduction. It's non-binding, so there's no demand. There's no imposition of anything on us or any other country. There's just a challenge set forth. The United States is not scapegoated as the, you know, the worst country in the world, but the United States has a unique leadership position in the world, and we can pretend we don't if we'd like, but it's not true. And I think when you're a team trying to fight a global problem, you really need to have some leaders, some particularly, you know, player coaches, if you would, who are kind of trying to organize the effort and make sure that it's moving forward. And I think for us to abandon that role that we've had since 1945 is not a smart move. And it's also true that whether or not China and India are going to be, you know, increasing their coal production as one of the means by which they power their economies, but under the context of trying to reduce their overall carbon emissions, they are therefore quite clearly involved in very high-level research on renewables. And China has made a huge investment in that, dwarfs the investment we've made in our country. And one of the fears I have about us pulling away from this agreement is that, shrinking away from the challenge rather than rising to it. I don't want some other country, namely China or India, to beat us to the finish line on really making renewables the wave of the future. Because if they get there first, we are their primary customer instead of them being our customers. Now, anybody who loves our country would realize that's not the place we want to be in.
John Martin is with us in studio right now, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and we're looking at the environmental impact of the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's decision to pull out of that agreement? Do you think it'll help or hurt the United States and the planet? Are you hopeful that the president will take other steps to protect the environment and fight climate change, or that, as seems to be happening, states and local governments might step up? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up with John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, looking at how U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement will affect the environment.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the president made the right call by getting out of the Paris Climate Agreement? Do you think there will be major consequences? Why or why not? Do you think the deal was unfair to the United States? Are you hoping that the United States still finds ways to contribute to preventing climate change? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go back to our calls now. We've got Dan on the line next in Green Bay. Dan, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to expand on something your speaker said earlier about, you know, possible winners and losers with climate change. Now, I live in Green Bay, so the frozen tundra, and I've read articles that, you know, maybe if we end up with a weather pattern in Wisconsin similar to, like, Maryland or Virginia, we might actually be a winner in that scenario agriculturally and the types of crops that we can grow, et cetera, et cetera. But if I lived in Las Vegas or Phoenix, you know, I might be really nervous about, you know, drought conditions and getting even hotter there. So I'd like your guess to comment on something like that.
Dan, thanks a lot. And John, what about Wisconsin? Do we know anything about how Wisconsin is projected to look?
Well, Wisconsin has a really, the University of Wisconsin and the Department of Natural Resources and other stakeholders in the state, some years ago, developed a program called the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, WICI. And Professor Dan Vimont in my department is one of the people who is sort of a high-profile leader in that organization. And so what that group did is it sort of looked, and still does, it looks at what might be the impacts on the state of Wisconsin from some of the climate changes that are, forecasted by the state-of-the-art climate models. And the caller has a good point. Of course, there would be some positive sides to a climate change here in central Wisconsin, let's say the Green Bay area, where it's more like Baltimore as opposed to Green Bay from the 1960s. Yeah, that's great. You might have a few warmer days. There might be greater agricultural production. But it turns out that a lot of the fish in lakes and streams, and we have a huge tourist industry that comes from fishing and other kinds of outdoor activities in the northern and central part of the state, they are exceptionally sensitive to the water temperature. So if that water temperature goes up or down a couple of degrees, entire species are at risk. And so then so is your tourism industry. So, and I'm not saying that, I'm not saying that to, you know, to cause fear and alarm, but I'm just pointing out that this is a very delicate tapestry we're talking about. It isn't just what will the temperature be during the growing season. There are many, many different aspects to this sort of change, how it manifests even locally. And one has to imagine trying to deal with all of them, not just one.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Dan. And now we go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm glad the president pulled us out of the accord. I don't think the accord really dealt with the base problem, which is the overpopulation. The United States will add 30 million more people in the next 10 years to this country. We've done nothing to become more ecologically, you know, efficient. We haven't cut a single high school football game out of the schedule. The Indy 500 is still 500 laps, not 499. We've created LED lights, but now instead of using them more efficiently, we're lighting up the candy aisle at the grocery store or every individual shelf. So we're wasting this wonderful new technology all in the sake of capitalism.
Mike, thank you for those thoughts there. And John, what do you say to that? We haven't done enough already. Look at that, says Mike. We're just as resource consuming as we ever were. And population control is not something that was tackled, he says, in the Paris Accord.
Yeah, I don't know about that or not, but I would think probably that's right, that that's not really a main issue in an accord that tries to deal with changing our habits about depositing things that we shouldn't be depositing at record levels into our atmosphere. So that's probably right. But I think if you stay in an agreement that challenges you, and again, it doesn't impose anything on us, it challenges us. If we meet the challenge, there will be littered along the way, along the path toward meeting that challenge, innovations that we can't imagine right now. That happened with the space program. Hundreds of innovations, technical innovations, many of which we use today. Everybody pulls a cell phone out to look at the weather, for instance. Both weather prediction and the technology involved in the cell phone had a direct connection to the space program. Who would have predicted that? And so I think if we reduce the urgency to meet challenges, then we certainly have the ancillary detrimental effect of reducing our likely innovations. So even just for that reason, I can't take issue directly with what Mike says, but I think I would take issue with the spirit of it. It's not a good reason to not be challenged just because you can't see any tangible evidence that you've made progress yet.
Professor John Martin is with us now from UW-Madison as we talk about the U.S. decision, President Trump yesterday saying the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. And we've got Jeremy with us next, calling from Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thank you. We cannot depend on Washington to do the right thing in regards to global warming and climate change. As much as we'd like to have them in our corner and be able to spearhead this, it's not going to happen. The Obama administration's got their fingerprints all over Keystone. It doesn't matter if you're Democratic or Republican. It just never seems to get anything moving forward in regards to global warming. It has to be a grassroots. Cities, states have to start taking accountability for themselves and start creating own legislation within their own cities and states to tackle this problem. It's not going to happen in Washington.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for that. And President Obama made a statement to that effect that local governments, states, private entities had to pick up the ball here and go with it and maybe could get the job done effectively there. What do you say to his point?
Well, there's no doubt that one has to keep the home fires burning, if you will. I think that's an important component to this whole crusade that we have to launch as a species. However, it isn't enough to say in Dane County we're going to do this, that, and the other thing to reduce our emissions, or in the state of Wisconsin, or in the United States broadly. This is a global problem, and in some ways it has dimensions that we've never, ever had to face before. Our current graduate population, that is people graduating college in the next 10 or so years, are going to be on the vanguard of a brand new challenge for which there is no script. And though it's true that this will be something that actually sustains its energy and sustains its drive to meeting the challenge from the grassroots level, it's different in a lot of ways. The grassroots will be grassroots done by people of means. For instance, people of means can buy an electric car. Somebody who is a little bit less affluent has to stay with that old Mustang. We have to make sure that we don't alienate people from the effort by suggesting that everybody should be involved in every single conceivable attack on this problem. On the other hand, we need some sort of federal and global organization to really make a substantial impact on what is a global problem.
And John, as we get close to the end, what do you think? Now that the U.S. has announced its intention to withdraw, from what I've heard, this could take about 4 years, puts us at about 2020 when we're at re-election. But do you think the center to this agreement holds? Do the rest of the countries involved stay committed, hold to their pledges, and make some progress without the United States?
I hope that's the case. I think that there's certainly incentives for countries that you might not expect to have incentives to do that. Some of the ones the president mentioned yesterday, China and India, they have real incentive, I think, maybe even enhanced incentive to stick to it and develop new technologies that will allow them to stick to it when the United States backs away. I really think that's the case. And so I'm concerned that though there'll be a benefit to the globe from those efforts, there will be a detrimental effect for us in the very long term because we won't be meeting this challenge with the urgency that I think spurs the innovation that will solve it.
And President Trump has said that he, quote, cares deeply about the environment. Do you see the U.S. still taking some kind of role, a leadership role perhaps, even though it is not involved in the Paris Accord?
No, I see no evidence at all that the president and the administration care about the environment. How could he possibly expect us to believe that when he appointed someone who's a climate denier? We don't know if the president is. He won't say. But he's a climate denier as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, established by Republican Richard Nixon. There's no evidence at all that the president has any interest at all in the environment, and we have to call him out on that, which I'm doing now.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, joined us to look at what President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement could mean for the environment.